I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. So my next interview is with Professor Nicholas Greco. He's an associate professor of communications and media at Providence University College, and he's written mostly about music. I mean, he's a cultural critic. He's as in his own words, he's kind of a sociologist. What I found really interesting about Nicholas is I love his sense of humor and his wit and his insight, but, you know, it's all about the message. It's all about the melody for, and the medium, I guess, for Nicholas. You know, as he says, quote, we don't just listen to music, close quote. So, I mean, I love that. He talks about television being a sacrament and about the differences and the connections between idealism and action. We talk a lot about U2, sadly. So if you're not a U2 fan, you're probably, well, you may not enjoy it, but you're still going to need to listen to the interview. Nicholas is a lot of fun. I think we're going to have a part two coming up soon. He even talks about the greatest song ever written, which is a pretty crazy claim to make. But I think you're going to really enjoy the interview with Nicholas. As I said, terrific guy, associate professor of communications and media. He's written a book about David Bowie recently, which we also talk about. And don't forget, davidpecklive.com. Check out the website for more interviews coming up weekly, and we will, hopefully, we'll see you soon.
Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a special digital guest once again, long distance. You know, we call this Face to Face, but it's pretty rare that I'm actually face to face. Anyway, we're joined today by Professor Nicholas Greco. He is the Associate Professor of Communications and Media at Providence University College. Nicholas, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me, David. This is a great thing. After a few weeks of sort of trying to catch each other, we finally found a time to speak, so I'm happy about that.
We've finally made some time. Well, apparently you spend all your time on iTunes, so...
Yeah, I do. I do. That's true. I've been listening to lots of internet radio, actually, in the last little while. So
how does a guy get a job like you, a high-level PhD academic writing about Morrissey? Mm-hmm. And U2 and David Bowie. In fact, you've published a new book called David Bowie in Darkness. Let's get that out there right away for our listeners. So a new book that's getting quite a bit of critical acclaim, I understand. David Bowie in Darkness, a study of, what is it? What's the subtitle?
A study of outside in the late career.
There you go.
A lot of people ask me what Outside is, and it's one of his lesser known albums that came out in 1995. To much critical acclaim, not as much fan acclaim, of course, because it's sort of challenging text, if you will, but a really interesting album, and probably the album that made me want to study David Bowie. And I'm in a great position to do this sort of work. I mean, you asked, you know, how does one get to study Morrissey or U2 or David Bowie at the level that I'm at? And I'm lucky to be able to do that. I think there's that great sort of spot in academia called Cultural Studies and Media Studies, where we actually get to talk about these things that lots of people invest their time and lots of their money and lots of their attention in. And so it's important stuff to study because people are spending a lot of themselves into this music as well.
So would you, I mean, you're obviously you're an academic, you're a professor, you're a teacher, you're a writer, but would you refer to yourself, I mean, are you a social critic? Are you a critic of pop culture? Are you a social scientist? I mean, where would you kind of land?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of a sociologist, I suppose.
Okay.
I mean, certainly in training, I'm a sociologist, but a sociologist more at the theoretical end of things. I don't do much. There's a term in sociology, ethnography, where you go out and you interview people and find out what they're thinking and so forth. I sort of went on the other end and did sort of semiotics, which is the study of signs and trying to figure out what things mean. And so I approach popular culture with that lens, trying to figure out what is going on there and what it means. So oftentimes I'll take a look at something, say, like U2 and look at it as a kind of problem, not a problem.
Hang on.
Yeah.
Be careful there, Nicholas. I mean, we're talking about my favorite band, okay?
Oh, I understand. I mean, they're one of my favorites as well.
Okay.
That's why I put that qualifier.
That's right.
It's a problem, David.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a problem.
Oh, I see.
I mean, not in the negative sense.
Yes.
Rather, something to be decoded.
Okay.
That's sort of what
sort of unpacked, looking at the nuances, the layers.
Yeah.
The importance of U2, yes.
Oh, certainly. just think about their last album that they put out, Songs of Innocence.
Yes.
Pushed down to people's phones everywhere. Anyone who had an iTunes account would suddenly woke up on in that September morning or whenever it was, and they found the songs on their phones. I mean, many people complained about that. Who is U2 and why are they on my phone? Just think about the hugeness of that. That people actually had this album. And even after all of that controversy, I think the album was, in fact, still being listened to by people in December. It was one of the top listened to albums on iTunes.
Yeah, for all the criticism, it really was
exactly.
Kind of a brilliant move, wasn't it, on their
I think
their
it
part.
Was. I mean, yeah. Even though it was highly criticized, and there were problems, I suppose, with the rollout, but that doesn't mean we should necessarily ignore something like U2. I mean, it is an icon of the age that we live in now. So,
well, it's kind of interesting, isn't it, about just because they're on my iPhone, I should now ignore them. I mean, that's an interesting notion in a sense, because, I mean, if you were to go back and look at any academic, any religious leader, any important politician, most of these folks, bands, people, movements have huge issues with them that could be critiqued and unpacked and criticized, and yet lots of value at the same time. So there's a real kind of paradox and contradiction there, isn't there?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
I think there was, I mean, there's a lot that's involved in the iTunes thing. Lots of people thought it was an invasion of privacy because they didn't choose to have this material on their phones. Many of them were not fans of U2. Many of them, I suspect, didn't even know who U2 was,
right.
At least if you see the tweets that...
Which is, frankly, an outrage to a fan like me.
Especially for those of us who are fans, right?
That's
why
right.
Not know who U2 is?
That's right.
In my classes, when I talk about U2, many of my students come to me afterwards and say, "You know, my parents would love what you said today."
Oh, do you know what?
Really?
I know. I have, you know, Spencer and Victoria, my two kids, and Spencer and I went to see the tour. I brought him with me at 10, and of course,
good.
He kind of enjoyed some of it, and you know, but really, it's music Dad listens to now, sadly, isn't it? I mean,
well, that's what they say, and I don't know. I mean, certainly my father never listened to U2, but I mean, you know, it's an interesting cultural artifact. That's the thing, and people just don't understand, because when you look at any video of U2 in particular, the sort of live concert video, there's a number of people that are participating in the live concert. You know, any one concert has thousands and thousands of people involved, and they put on these massive touring shows, and the number of people that they are reaching is astronomical, and so, you know, whether we are fans of them or not, I think we need to look at them. And this is the same with Bono. Many people call Bono this sort of pompous kind of figure that is full of ego and so forth. But the fact that he is so out there, I think, means that we have to take a look at him.
So Ellen McGirt wrote a recent article in Fortune magazine that maybe we can talk about briefly.
Yeah, sure.
I want to hear more about your book on Bowie and just why anyone would want to write this kind of stuff in the first place. But Ellen McGirt writes, Irish rock icon Bono leads a widely, quote, acclaimed, data-driven global organization that influences governments, rallies C-suites, raises hundreds hundreds of millions of dollars for people living in poverty. What's his secret? An ability to convince others that they are the true leaders of change, not him, close quote. A lot of people are just groaning right now as they're listening to this, I'm sure, right? Because he's got this messianic complex and what a massive ego. My wife Elizabeth is not a huge fan of his stage presence, but she loves him and what he does. And I think I've always seen them sort of as part and parcel of who you two are, who Bono is, I suppose, an extension of the band themselves. But but a lot of people wouldn't be able to go there. And I guess maybe that's part of my question too, Nicholas, in the sense that don't most people just listen to music? Like, holy smokes, why do you unpack it? Why do you need to look at the, you know, it's a good melody or it's not, you know?
Yeah, you know, we don't just listen to music. That's the thing. Like, we think we do. We think we just listen to music. And you know, maybe that's it's becoming more problematic lately because of the, you know, rise of streaming services where people are listening to music, but they're not necessarily, you know, finding that particular album and, you know, going out to the record store, let's say, and purchasing that and listening to it nonstop. Oftentimes, I think now, with especially with streaming services, there's more of a buffet quality. You're just listening to whatever is cool that particular week. But I don't think we ever really just listen to music. I think when we engage with any of these sorts of media, we are, in fact, engaging them with various layers of our mind. I mean, it's not only just listening. We are decoding what's going on there. We just don't think we are, but we are. I mean, I understand that there might be this idea of ubiquitous music, music that's just sort of on in the background. But in that case, we're not really listening to it either. There's lots.
So can I just toss something in there? Sure. Maybe as you unpack that, are you concerned? So as a sort of a you know, a kind of a sociologist, as you said, are you more interested in the melody or the message, or are they both intertwined? Like in other words, the lyrics. You know, a lot of people. Well, I don't really listen to the lyrics.
No, you have to look at everything. The melody or the message. The melody contains a message as well. I mean, this is the famous sort of Marshall McLuhan's famous quote that even some of my colleagues don't really understand. The medium is the message.
Right.
There is a message there in the very music that we're listening to. So even melody has a message in it. And I'm thinking back to my musicological days when I did a couple of music degrees before I did my my doctorate, so I sort of have a little bit of that sense, musical sense, if you will. But yeah, there are messages there as well. It's not only through the lyrics that we get to know things; it's also through the music too. So yeah, that's all there. It's all there, and there's so much. That's the thing, is we think that even the most sort of vapid pop song has, you know, it has nothing in it. It's just sort of drivel. But there is stuff there. We make associations all the time when we're listening to music, and that's important to sort of dig out.
Do you think, you know, I mean, are you, oh man, let's go back to a song that I grew up with. Oh, isn't this bizarre? Okay, you're going to think I'm nuts, and I don't know. The Monks, were they a band back in the 80s?
They could have been.
The Monks.
You were probably the only one listening.
Was the only one listening, and I'm going to actually search it right now. Drugs in my pocket, and I don't know what to do with them.
Okay,
everyone just quickly shut off this podcast, by the way. So the band is called The Monks. Drugs in my pocket.
Okay.
So from an album called Bad Habits, released in 1979, I was in my early teens. I'm not a drug addict today, Nicholas.
No.
So.
Right.
Is there any case, you know, my parents would have been out, like, they would have hit the roof if they'd known that I, and in fact, did. I remember a song playing, I think it was Sting, playing on MTV, on, believe it or not, on television. And my mother walked into the room and she started to sort of hammer me on the lyrics.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what that actually means, don't you?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I do, Mom, but anyway. So I guess I don't know what my question is, but I think is, you know, clearly music, message, there are implications that, like you say, these are cultural drivers, they inform us in a certain way. Are you that concerned about that, I guess?
Well, no, I'm not. I mean, I, you know, the Monks didn't make you take drugs, nor did, you know, me listening to David Bowie make me take cocaine. You know, I didn't start on a diet of 2% milk, red peppers, and cocaine because
really?
Bowie did that. I didn't.
Yeah, I thought that's how you ended up at Providence.
don't start spreading rumors.
That's right.
No, it's music does influence us. I'm not saying that music is not influential, because of course it is an important cultural force. But we are also, all of us have free will. We are not robots that simply consume material and then go and do it. There was a study years ago, not a study, but there was a sort of a criticism years ago. There was a film, and I don't remember which film it was, but in the film, a bunch of the main characters decide to line themselves up on the yellow lines of a street. They sort of lie down on the street as cars are zipping past them, and there was a huge uproar about this, because, you know, won't young people decide to go and lie down on the street because they see this thing in the movies? And, of course, no one did that, because that's stupid.
Now you're sounding like an academic again.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the thing. And so, you know, I mean, Bono talks about loving people. I mean, he's got a whole song that's talking about Yahweh.
Yes.
You know, he is speaking to Yahweh. Well, you don't see droves of people, at least explicitly, knowingly speaking to God just because Bono says so. I mean, we don't have this move towards social justice because Bono pushes for it. I mean, this is the other thing, right? We can talk about how, you know, listening to Queen makes you want to smoke marijuana, which used to be something I heard when I was young. You can talk about that, but you can't say that, you know, that music also does good things. But it does, of course.
Well, there was this whole movement. I mean, the whole backward masking movement. And I mean, it's just the absurdity of all that. I mean,
yeah, and that's what I'm referring to with the marijuana thing.
Like, let's go out and burn our records. In fact, I know people who did that, you know, as a result of some of the messages and some of the stuff that was being communicated. I mean, and so often what's interesting to me, some of the stuff that my kids are starting to listen to already, and I'm kind of listening to them with it. Video is so much a component now of the music as well. And so you've got a whole other, not only art form, but another medium, another message being communicated, right? Another articulation of it, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I use the term mediation. It's yet another way for the band or for the musicians to be mediated. We see them in another way. We engage with them in another way. And so that's, you know, there was something in the Forbes article. It mentions that Bono is number 14 on Forbes magazine's World's Greatest Leaders list.
Which is crazy when you think about it, right?
It is.
A rock star. Yeah.
Yeah. I just thought that was interesting. Tim Cook from Apple says that he's got idealism and action, both of those things combined, an unusual mix of traits that generally people don't have. But
yes,
Bono seems to have both of those, idealism and action. And I suspect that the idealism part of it is probably, you know, his rock and roll roots are probably what helps with that idealism.
There's something really amazing to me about the band and just their what I would almost call the thread that runs throughout their band. I mean, having, you know, being a fan and having read lots about them and listened to their music for years, following them since, I don't know, 1987, I suppose, maybe even before that, saw them with Joshua Tree tour in Toronto in the Exhibition Stadium, which doesn't even exist anymore, you know, blown away, people leaving the building, singing together, thousands of people singing 40 as they walk out of the, you know, you just, this is a concert experience and unlike pretty much every other concert I've been to, and I'm no, you know, a groupie of any band, really, but I guess I've been to a fair amount of concerts over the years. I don't think I've seen that kind of community anywhere else.
Yeah, we joke amongst my colleagues about U2 being a great church experience, that going to a U2 show is like going to church, a very spiritual kind of experience.
Certainly, well, and great sporting events can be the same too, right?
Yeah, that wouldn't be unique necessarily. I mean, the notion of transcendence in a concert experience, that happens quite often. I remember being at a Radiohead show in Ottawa, and that was, for me, this sort of spiritual experience. But I don't know if that was because of Radiohead or it was because I was with a woman that I really liked at the time.
Right. Well, I think it had more to do with the haze of marijuana smoke, you know, that was, you know, probably right at about eye level.
That's quite possible as well. You know, so I don't know what that was exactly. But certainly U2, I mean, we talk about U2 and the moments that Bono, when he's on stage, he can break through something that maybe other bands don't. He seems to break through the terrestrial, if you will. He's somehow able to channel a divinity of some kind, you know. And for those of us who understand the context of U2, we could say he's able to actually somehow, you know, reach Christ and make Christ touch through that concert, the crowd that's there. They may not realize that they're meeting with God, but I think they actually are in a U2 concert. But
do you think? Do you think
able to do that?
Yeah, that's really cool. Do you think there's something kind of religious, I suppose, maybe, or is that the right word I'm looking for? Ritualistic, maybe, about the notion of a rock concert in itself, you know, getting 20, 30, 40. I mean, I went to see the biggest concert I've ever been to would have been about 50,000 people, I suppose. I mean, that's a crazy amount of people in one place that are there for the same reason.
Yeah, all of that, I think, points to the ritualistic notion of community, and it taps into sort of long-standing traditions of meeting together to try to access the spiritual. Certainly, that all works toward that. I just think that you can't ignore when Bono is on stage and he's quoting one of the Psalms at the start of Where the Streets Have No Name. You can't just ignore that. It is in fact a moment of the divine. You've got them breaking out into the refrain of Hallelujah at the end of Walk On or whatever. These are moments where that sort of facade between earth and heaven is broken, even for a moment. And I'd like to think, I guess as a theorist, that even if people don't know that it's happening, that it's happening anyway. And I guess, you know, before I was joking with you a little bit about, you know, when Bono was singing Yahweh, it's not like a million people have come to a saving knowledge of Jesus or something. It's not like a bunch of people are praying because Bono says so. But in many ways, maybe they are, right? I mean, that's the other way of looking at it, sort of a theoretical way of looking at it. Maybe when they are singing along to Bono, they are, in fact, making change because they're calling out to God.
So would we be different people if we weren't listening to this kind of music? I mean, on some level, that's a pretty silly question. But on another level, I'm kind of interested to hear what you have to say.
You know, I always say to people when we talk about things like this sort of idea, I often say, you know, it doesn't seem that it could be, but on a theoretical level, yes. And so I would say, you know, we would not be the same. We would not have the same kind of experience. We would not have the same kind of experience if we didn't listen to this music. I talk about television as a sacrament in one of my papers, and people are like, they think about that and they say, that's ridiculous. You know, the idea that watching television could actually be grace giving to you. It's a really weird idea, and I have this whole sort of framework around that to try to explain what I'm thinking. But I suspect that listening to some music is sacramental, and maybe in these kinds of examples, Bono singing Yahweh, this is sacramental. This is us touching the divine, and the divine perhaps coming and imparting grace to us, even through this particular action. I think it happens, and maybe we're limiting it so much to, you know, that particular church tradition or that particular time when we're in church, and we think that the spiritual actually comes down and touches us or changes us. Maybe this happens more often than we think it does.
I'm reading a book right now called Why Did They Kill? It's by Alexander Hinton. It's about genocide in Cambodia. As my listeners know, it's a place that I travel to often and have been working at for years on different variety of different levels. He talks just recently fairly significantly about some of the songs that the Khmer Rouge used, some of the lyrics, the way that this hyper-communistic ideology was spread. You know, and it was through the airwaves as well. They had a pretty unsophisticated radio system. There's the one of the radio towers still stands up in a province, a place called Analong Vang, right on the Thai border where Pol Pot died and was buried, and the importance of it, right, and the impact, and how that would be very different today, I think, with social media and access and immediate sort of global access to the world around us. I would think the messages would be communicated differently, but I just think about this power, and you see some of these images. I think of some of the not Hitler Youth, to go from U2 to propaganda might be a bit of a stretch, but in some ways not so much.
No, I mean, they've used that term themselves sort of in a, I think, in a more tongue-in-cheek kind of way with their fan magazine was called Propaganda. I think that came out during
the year. Okay, so now you're just showing yourself as not only an academic, but a nerd as well. I love it. You know that, you know their fan magazine. That's awesome.
Yeah, I was never a subscriber to it, but I...
Hey, I was. Nicholas,
oh, very good.
I have some copies I'd be happy to send your way. So
yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah. No, I think well, wasn't that Zoo TV? I mean, in a way, I don't think they really totally take themselves seriously.
Well, I think, I think they were showing that they were, I think, rather than them not taking themselves seriously, I mean, certainly they're able to joke about themselves, but I think more so they wanted to show that they weren't just a band.
Right.
They were something much bigger than
right,
that.
Right, right.
And I think, you know, you were saying earlier that you were suggesting that Bono is in many ways what U2 is. I don't know if that's exactly what you're saying, but it doesn't really matter what you were saying. What matters is what I'm saying. And so
that's
I think that actually the band is an expansion of Bono in many ways. I mean,
was that a quote from Bono, by the way? Because that sounds like something he would say. It doesn't matter what you're saying. It only matters what I'm about to say.
Listen, as long as the CEO of Coca-Cola and the CEO of Apple listen to him, that's probably
okay. It's not too bad, eh? Yeah.
Yeah, I think the band is in many ways an expansion, if you will, of Bono's own experience.
Mm-hmm.
He grew up with difference, religious difference, with his parents, one being Protestant and the other being Catholic, and this kind of very interesting model for him of what lived Christianity is supposed to be like.
So that's a really okay. So now all of a sudden our podcast is entirely about U2, which believe me, I'm okay with. But and maybe we're going to have
easily be shifted to any topic. That
yeah.
Talk to me about.
Well, maybe we're going to have to do a part two down the road. But just before we go back to Bowie and your book and so on,
sure.
and maybe just also, I mean, I've run through your CV. I mean, you're writing about Feist and Morrissey, and it's I mean, rock music in particular, it seems to me. I mean, you're very, very specific with some of that. I'd like to hear more about some of your observations with respect to some of those things. But there's an interest. I mean, I think part of the reason why this band has been able to stay together for so many years is there's got to be something going on there from a relational perspective, an ego perspective.
Right.
Does the band, and I'm sure they're not thrilled to think that maybe they are, in fact, an extension of Bono's ideology. Maybe that's a massive oversimplification. I don't know. But they do still seem to be one.
Right.
know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I do.
And as corny as that sounds, and even the title of one of their songs and all of that, there's a glue there. That you don't most other rock bands in the world just don't seem to have.
Yeah, there's a glue there, and you're, I mean, it does sound simplistic and perhaps very corny. This idea that they are one or whatever, but they're one in many in their differences, right?
Right.
So you've got Bono, who's got a Protestant and Roman Catholic parents, whichever one it is. I keep forgetting who is who, but you know what I mean.
Yes, yes.
And you've got other members of the band that perhaps don't have such an explicit kind of Christianity, and Adam Clayton has often been touted as the one who's not a Christian or whatever, whereas the other ones somehow are. But the thing is, they are all very different, I think.
Yes.
They are an extension of Bono's life in that they are different elements that are brought together, and somehow in their conflict, if you will, they stay as one.
Yes.
And in many ways, when we look at U2, it teaches us how to live together in some ways. And I think that's kind of the sacramental nature, too, maybe, of listening to U2, is that it gives us a pattern. It gives us something that will maybe improve our lives by emulating what they're doing. And I shouldn't sort of use the word emulation so flippantly. I'm not saying we should act the way they do, but they show us something. They show us a particular ideal, perhaps, of how to stay together.
Well, I mean, we could do a whole podcast on the whole notion of idealism and activism. I mean, for a guy who's all about social change, about the splash and ripple effect, about the domino theory, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I want to make the world a better place, and how do you bring those two things together? Great, it's perfect. You can talk a good game. You can reach beyond your grasp in a conversation, but are you actually, when the rubber needs to meet the road, are you gonna put boots on the ground? Are you gonna actually act? Are you gonna make a difference? Right?
This is the thing with music in general, and I'm talking sort of about popular music and maybe even popular culture. It's not so much what it tells us in terms of the lyrics or the content or whatever. It's what it shows us in all that it represents. I mean, oftentimes it can show us bad things. You know, we shouldn't treat each other the way that Donald Trump treats people on The Apprentice, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if
we're
watching a reality TV show, that's not how we should necessarily treat each other. That doesn't necessarily have much to do about what people are saying. I mean, it's important to look at discourse too and what people are saying, but I think that's oftentimes what we don't think about. We sort of want to look at the content and take a look at how many times a swear word is being said in a movie or whatever.
I love those kind of reviews. The F word was used 12 times.
Yeah, right. We don't go sort of deeper into it to try to figure out what exactly is going on there and what it's showing us. And in fact, even those movies that might have swear words in them might have something very important.
Nicholas, what do you say to people who just, well, you know what, I just listen to the music, it's in the background. You know, people often say, you know, I'm a bit of a cinephile, I love film, and I've got quite a few, for those of you out there who want to listen to quite a few interviews with filmmakers over the past year and a half. I don't believe we go to movies just to be entertained. I mean, I even though we might go into a movie saying, "Oh, I just want to be entertained. It's James Bond. The latest cartoon with my kids." We are constantly being informed. I mean, there's a story there that we are taking in whether we want to or not. So, is it the power of the cumulative effect that's even maybe, you know, playing in the background, if you will?
I think it's simply how we engage with this media. We sometimes lie to ourselves and say, I'm only going to be entertained, or I'm going to go, I've got nothing to do tonight, I'm going to flop on the couch and just vegetate as I'm watching television. We lie to ourselves because that's not actually how it works. I mean, in communications theory, we talk about encoding and decoding. There's encoding that goes on by the sender, and there's decoding that happens with the receiver. The only time when we're not actually decoding is when we're asleep, you know, when we're actually not engaged at all. But if we're watching stuff, we're listening to stuff, if we're hearing it, then we are somehow decoding it. We are engaged with it. You know, don't think that you're not. That's what I often tell my students. Don't think that you're just sitting there and consuming. You're not. You're actually, you're translating what you're getting into something that's meaningful for you. And so in many ways, that means we have to be vigilant or whatever, and sort of place a kind of importance on what we are taking in, because we are engaging with it. On the other hand, I mean, we're not just robots. And that's the thing I said earlier. We're not just we don't do whatever the media tells us. We're smarter than that, I think.
Isn't there a sense, quoting from the Fortune article about Bono, thinking about, you know, other artists over the years who have had things to say, actors, you know, they get up in front of the camera, you know, at the Oscars, and they'll make a comment. I mean, on one hand, I am thrilled when people use their celebrity to affect change, to get a message out on the street. But there's another part of me that just, maybe it's not me so much, the cynic, I guess, in me that says, why should I give a rat's ass what you think?
Mm-hmm.
You're a bazillionaire off of a bunch of music that you wrote, or you acted well in a particular movie, like, big deal. Like, I think there's a, do you know what I mean? Like, there's a bit of a paradox there for sure. Maybe it's not a paradox, but there's an incongruency, it seems to me.
Yeah, certainly there's a problem. But I would just say that it is not as simple as we make it out to be.
Mm.
It's much more complex. I mean, Bono is a millionaire. You know, U2 is a huge corporation that makes millions and millions of dollars. And sure, there are tax havens and places that they put their money that makes them make more money. You know, that's one part of it. But the other part of it is Bono being on stage. You know, in 2007, he got the NAACP. It was some sort of award from the NAACP in the States for his activism. And he talked about AIDS in Africa. He had this whole spiel thanking all the various members of NAACP, Julian Bond and others that were there. And he sounds kind of foolish, talking about his upbringing as an Irish, almost pink person, he mentions. and then he, but at one point in the 7-minute speech, he sort of switches, and he suddenly goes into a tirade about what it means to be a follower of Christ and what that means regarding our responsibility to people in the world.
Wow.
And the crowd, of course, responds to this, particularly because of their context and so forth. But they respond to this so powerfully, and it's as if there's a switch being switched.
Right,
and
it's
a great moment, and it goes to show, I might not care, but it doesn't mean that he can't do what he's doing.
Yeah, right. Right.
And it doesn't mean that it won't affect me either.
Well, and aren't we talking to some degree about generosity and grace and the ability to handle such the madness that is celebrity?
Sure.
Right? It must be utterly insane to live in that world and to be hounded for photographs and autographs and you can't go anywhere. I mean, I would think there must be some, I would hope there's some sort of obligation that must be felt at some level to say, wow, I hope I'm using this wisely.
Well, you know, we don't know what it's like to be a celebrity. We really don't. I mean, you might, David, but we don't know what it's like.
There was this old joke that, you know, I used to work at a comedy and magic club, a nightclub in Toronto, a show that ran for 9 years called A Little Night Magic, and there was an MC, Glenn Ottaway, and he used to talk about, hey, would anybody like an autograph or something like that? And the joke was, I signed 100 photos before I got here tonight, you know, like, you know, I've got them there if you want them.
Exactly.
We
don't know what it's like to be a celebrity, and I think that's just part of the complexities of it.
Yeah.
It's not as
simple
as we think. Celebrity is not just a bunch of people sitting around and beds of money or whatever. Like that. In some ways, we hope that a celebrity, if they do have the opportunity to affect change, we would hope that they would do that, and hopefully for the better, right? And I think that's one thing about Bono. I mean, we can say that he's an idiot, we could say that he's a hypocrite, but I don't think we can deny that he's helped to change things for the better, at least for a certain group of people in the world. And so, we have to give him credit for at least that.
So, do you actually enjoy listening to music?
I do.
Or do you like sit there with your notepad out and you're listening to a song?
Not really.
No.
Not really. But I remember when I listened to this David Bowie album from 1995. I was enthralled by what I was hearing.
Mm-hmm.
It really wasn't that I had a notebook there and I was feverishly writing things down and then looking at obscure French theorists to try to figure out what was going on. That wasn't the case at all. But certainly it's the music that I enjoy that I then enjoy writing about. The magic does not leave for me when I move that curtain away to see what's going on behind. The magic for me is not gone. It's reinforced. So, yeah, I do enjoy listening to music.
So it's more about the implications for you, it seems to me, than maybe actually the music itself or the lyric itself, or
potential of what that lyric and that music does.
I was going to say, can you separate the two? You probably can't.
You can't really. I mean, you can look at what's going on in the lyrics, and you could look at what's going on in the music, but you have to take both of those things together at some level and sort of figure what's going on in the music as a whole. And I'd also throw into that, album covers and videos and all of that. You need to take a look at the whole thing.
Well, it's, I skateboarded as a kid and 35 years ago, and I've got several broken bones and a couple concussions to prove it. And an old
That's
picture.
That's why I never skateboarded.
Well, and an old picture in the Etobicoke Guardian. I mean, I grew up listening to just because I was in that environment with other skateboarders, Sex Pistols, Dead Kennedys, some pretty heavy duty punk, that I wouldn't say, I mean, to say that it didn't shape me, I think would be kind of foolish, but I think it was a part of the story that I was a part of that allowed me to say, hang on, I'm not exactly thrilled with the way things are.
Sure.
And I want to question, and I went on to study philosophy, and I went on, right. And so you kind of wonder, you look back, you understand, and you start to see some of those connections, and music is such a huge part of most people's lives.
Yeah, and when I talk to students, I often say that, you know, what music do you like? What movies do you like? What's the stuff that really gets you excited? And sometimes they come back with a really sort of a blasé kind of answer. They'll be like, well, I don't really listen to much music. I like anything, really, and
right,
movies are not
right,
my thing. And that sort of stuff. But I always have to probe a little deeper, because I'm sure there is stuff that they will mm-hmm, go back mm-hmm. and listen to. If they are anything like I was when I was much younger, you know, they will gravitate to particular things, and I always want to know why they do that, what makes them want to listen to that stuff or engage with that material. That's the fascinating thing for me. Where is it? You know, where's the site of their engagement? What is the desire that they have? How does that come about?
Is it, Nicholas, is this more of a Western kind of a thing? I mean, could we go into Ouagadougou in Burkina Faso and find, you know, young people listening to the latest music? I mean, obviously you can physically,
yeah,
if you've got
could,
a device, but
yeah,
are they is the question.
Yeah, certainly this is a Western thing. I think the whole discipline of media studies is a Western idea. Cultural studies, there's a discipline called cultural studies, and oftentimes people come to me and say, well, is cultural studies the study of cultures? And I say, well, kind of, but it's actually the study of our own culture.
Mm.
I mean, it is Western culture that we're focusing on, because we've built the whole idea of media and popular culture. These are the ways that we've talked about them, you know, creating commodities that people will listen to and consume and so forth. This is all a very Western idea. So we might be able to find it in other areas of the world, but only because of Western imperialism, probably.
Nice.
You know, they've done. I mean, they've created cultural industries themselves.
Sure.
As well, I suspect, but that's only because we did so.
So just before we're going to have to wrap up in a few minutes, sadly. But just before we come to an end, tell me what the greatest song ever written is.
Wow, that's
it's a ridiculous question.
That's a difficult question. The greatest song ever written. Oh, that's hard. Boy, David, you didn't give me any warning.
I didn't.
At all.
I didn't, because it's an absurd question. I mean,
No,
go.
I'll try to do it. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Please.
There's a and it's a U2 song, what we talked about earlier.
Nice.
But it's I've got two here,
okay,
but I'll give you both of them if I do so quickly. On The Unforgettable Fire, there's a song, the name is escaping me right now. It's on the second side of Unforgettable Fire. But what it is it's Bono basically singing over A Sort of Homecoming, which is the first track,
mm-hmm.
That's been kind of slowed down and messed up. And he's singing over it, and he's singing over it in such a way that really suggests that he didn't prepare. I don't know if you know what I'm talking
Interesting.
About.
Yeah, kind of almost like a free verse.
That's right, exactly. So that's one example of the best song ever written.
Interesting, okay.
The reason why is because it moves you in ways that you would not expect it to move you. You are carried along by the music in ways that you probably weren't expecting to. Next time you listen to Unforgettable Fire, I've cursed you now.
That's you have, I'm because saying. Basically as soon as I hang up with you, I'm going to listen to that piece again. I thought you were going to say Bad. That's where I thought you were going.
No. But, you know, you can believe that. Here's the second best
okay,
song
good.
Ever in the world.
Yes.
It's, again, on the, it's U2 again, but it's a live rendition of, I believe it's Yahweh, and I could be wrong, on the U2 18 album.
Okay.
There was a DVD that came with that was live good. In Milan, and I may be wrong, but the reason why it's so great, Yahweh live, is because the bass player is playing the guitar.
Interesting, okay.
And you're going to say that sounds ridiculous, right? But it changes things. This is the thing. It just changes things. It's a little thing that switches, and you're like, why would Adam Clayton be playing the guitar in this song? But he is. And suddenly the song gets a new meaning, because
right.
normally Adam Clayton is in the back.
Yes.
Now he's
yes.
in the front.
Now he's in
and
the
that's
front.
Very important for those of us who
you
look
could,
at...
You couldn't have just picked like a Rolling Stone, eh?
My colleague Michael Gilmore would pick
okay. up. Okay, fair enough. So tell me about the book. We'll have to wrap. I'll certainly direct people towards that on the site and in the bio, but tell me a little bit about the book, about Bowie, and why you're
yeah.
excited about it.
You know, David Bowie is a legend, certainly now after his death. He's become much more than he was in his life, I think. And his later career is a part of his career that people don't look at. If you took a look at all various tributes that happened in the last little while since his death in January, most of the tributes focused on his music prior to 1983, nothing after 1983. And so that area is a sort of black hole. But I think it's probably, it's a black hole for a reason, because Bowie made it such. And it was David Bowie in shadows, in darkness, as I suggest in the title. It was a way for him to negotiate his worldwide celebrity. The fact that he was a massive celebrity, but he also wanted to be apart from his fans. And that's a fascinating tension, to actually need the spotlight to be a celebrity, but also to shun that same group of people at the same time. And so that was what fascinated me. Outside from 1995 becomes a kind of central piece to that whole era. So I'm just sad that Bowie doesn't get the credit he deserves in terms of his later career. And Black Star, by the way, which was his last album that came out in January, it was a fine album when it came out, but the 2 days that was there before we found out he died, it was released on Friday, and I believe he died on the Saturday or the Sunday. But those 2 days, it was just an okay album. Once he died, though, that album became something much different. It becomes a legendary album. So.
I think the main question of the interview is, Nicholas, how do I get a free copy of this book?
You know what? If you send $30 to Amazon.ca, they'll send you a free copy.
It's remarkable how that works.
Isn't it great?
It's fabulous.
Yeah.
Professor Nicholas Greco, he's the Associate Professor of Communications and Media at Providence. What's Providence University College?
That's right.
And his most recent book, David Bowie and Darkness, published by McFarlane and Company, 2015. We're going to have to do a part two and ignore everyone else except Bono and The Edge, and Larry. I think that could be the title of the interview. What do you think about that?
It sounds fine. Let's do it.
Let's do it. Thanks a lot for your time today.
Of course.